Hi, this is Daniel Garber, the movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. It's the 1980s. Ishmael Ali is on a commercial flight to the U.S. Virgin Islands, but not to lie on the beaches of St. Croix. He's being transferred to a maximum security prison. He's serving time for the Fountain Valley Massacre, that infamous killing at a golf course owned by the Rockefellers, a crime he says he didn't commit. And on the flight, he manages to hijack the plane to Cuba. But there's much, much more to this skyjacker's tale. A Skyjacker's Tale is a new feature documentary that interviews the skyjacker himself in Cuba. It tells his story and that of all the people he affected, both at the skyjacking and at the trial that led to it. These interviews shed new light on a controversial case with a dramatic finish that left the public polarized. A Skyjacker's Tale is directed by award-winning filmmaker Jamie Kastner, who brought us films like Kike Like Me. I spoke to Jamie about the secret disco revolution 4 or 5 years ago, and I'm very pleased to have him back again in studio to talk about A Skyjacker's Tale. Hi, Jamie. Nice to see you again.
Hi, Daniel. Thank you for having me.
So this is a fascinating story that I vaguely knew about, but it wasn't at the front of my mind until I saw this documentary. So let's start with some context. The skyjacker, Ishmael Ali, previously known as Ishmael Labit,
that's right, yeah.
Says he was a political prisoner in the United States when he hijacked the plane to Cuba. Can you talk about his political background and his beliefs?
Well, I'll just say, first of all, the way I came to understand Ali and the many dimensions of him are similar in some way to the way the film is ultimately constructed. In other words, I heard about this story quite – I'll just go way back if you don't mind.
Yeah. How did you hear about the story?
I heard about it completely at random through my car mechanic on the east side, S&S Motors. I should start publicizing them.
For sure.
They've given me a film. And Chris Syme, my mechanic there, is a very kind of bright, politically minded guy himself who knew I did documentaries. And he told me that he had a buddy who goes down to Cuba regularly and met this guy in a bar in Cuba. And would I be and the guy's interested in telling his story, would I be interested? And there in the shop, we Google Ishmael Labit. And there he is. There's the story of the hijacking and this strange story of this murder on a golf course and so on. And this is my first kind of glimpse and the first headlines I get of this guy. Through this middleman, friend of Chris's, I wind up getting in touch with Ali, as he calls himself now. And one thing led to another, as it were, and then I was in a cab riding across Cuba within a couple of months, I'd say, of that original introduction, and reading a kind of long out of print vanity published book about the trial that had been written 20 years before and the whole murder and so on, and believing at that time that I was on my way to meet a guy who had murdered 8 people. Once I met him and was vetted by him and he decided to move forward with the film, a whole other side to the story began to open up.
Well, let's talk about, before the skyjacking, let's talk about the crime and the repercussions. It's funny, when I was a kid, I went on a school trip to the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Oh, really?
And we went to St. Thomas and St. John. They said, we can't go to St. Croix. It's too dangerous. I'm saying, why? And it's because many years earlier, there had been this
crime. So it is still a very notorious crime, rightly or wrongly, quite honestly. Well, I mean, it wasn't a good thing that 8 people got killed on a golf course, but the proportion of hysteria, let's call it, that it still generates 40 years later.
Years later,
it's completely out of whack. Yeah. I mean, particularly given what a dangerous place it is down there. You know, 8 murders isn't such a big deal there now, I can tell you. And even at the time, it was one of a whole wave of crimes that, if not directly political, each and every one, certainly spoke to a situation of unrest that was being born out of the great imbalance of power on that island.
But this one has a...
So this crime, it's a bizarre crime. It's... And honestly, it's hard at a glance to figure what the political angle is of it, if there is one. Anyway, so the crime involves, it's 3 p.m. in the afternoon on a weekday in a golf course owned by the Rockefellers called Fountain Valley at the time. And five masked men in fatigues burst in with a whole a battery of weapons. There's a handful of people kind of like having lunch, and they're like pilots who are there or stewardesses, as they were called at the time, and, you know, people who are working at the club. And in what appears to be a robbery gone wrong, well, there's all sorts of theories about what it was, but in any case, there was, it was empty your pockets on the table, and then shooting starts, and 8 people are killed, and another 8 or so are injured as well. This is a very bizarre crime, and at the time, at least in the way it's remembered, you know, and of course history is as we know is written with very specific intentions depending on who's telling the story, but let's say by the way it's remembered by the white people telling the rich white people telling the story, completely peaceful island where no one ever locked their doors and nothing bad ever happened. Never mind that this is actually 2017 is the anniversary, is the 100th anniversary of the year that the colony of the Virgin Islands was sold to America, whence it became basically an American colony, which it remains to this day, under some other name, but that's basically what it is.
Okay, yep. So what I hear is it's this crime was painted as a race war.
Yes, that's how that was the immediate reaction to the crime was, white people beware, the natives are on the rampage, basically. Now, even at the time, this didn't quite add up because one of the victims actually was black. One of the victims who died was black, but others who were injured were also black. So it was kind of a fairly, whatever it was, whoever did it, it was a fairly wild kind of rampage thing. And it was, there was, by the way, less than $1,000 in the till. So it really is a hard crime to fathom. You know, it's what was the objective of it?
But in any case, they rounded up a bunch of people because there was no one there at the crime afterwards, but they went into the woods on the island and rounded up a bunch of people, one of whom was Ali.
Yes, exactly. They launched a huge manhunt calling in, it was the governor, the governor at the time was a kind of Nixon appointee, as was the federal judge in this case. And they had a very direct line kind of right up the political ladder. And so in short order, scores of U.S. Deputy U.S. Marshals were flown in, FBI from San Juan. There was 125-man manhunt, and they were about to call in like naval Coast Guard helicopters and all this stuff as well. Actually, there was a helicopter, but in any case, it was a huge thing, you know, on a small island.
So it goes to trial, and that's on the government, the Nixon's government side. But what about the defense side?
What winds up happening in the defense side is that, so yes, they wind up these 5 local guys, of whom Ali, or Labit as he then was, is one. And these guys were known to have had a background of activism. You know, Ali had been... had been had been in Vietnam. He had been dishonorably discharged from Vietnam. He went to New York. He New York and Chicago. He did some work with the Black Panthers, and then at a certain point, he came back to the islands. You know, sort of feeling that his true struggle was back home, and was part of there had been kind of budding leftist groups on the island that had been kind of swiftly snuffed out, and he and his friends were part of an effort to get something else going. They were part of a group that called themselves the Young Bloods, but they never got that far. Anyway, so Ali and his cohorts, this is the sort of type of guy that they arrested, five of these activists. I mean, they weren't saints, but then it was a kind of, you could characterize the entire United States at that point as a sort of race war. You could characterize the United States today as a race war. But in any case, it was a sort of roundup, the usual suspects. And somehow word got to the most famous lawyer in America at the time, William Kunstler, hot off the heels of defending the Chicago Seven. And he took the case.
This is 1972.
1971 was the crime.
Right.
So it was within a matter of months. September 1971 was the crime. And or am I getting it confused now with the year of, well, anyway.
Anyway, the Chicago 7 was the Democratic Convention.
That was 68.
Right.
Well, 68, but 68, yeah, right. The trial happened subsequently. Yeah. So yes, it was sort of soon after that. And he had really run circles around the judge in that case, Kunstler, and turned into a whole, you know, famous circus, of course. And so he was the most famous lawyer in America. He had also worked with Martin Luther King and, you know, was you know.
Bill Kunstler, very, very famous lawyer.
Father. He took the case. There was another quite renowned lawyer who was hired named Chauncey Eskridge, who had been Muhammad Ali's lawyer, had also worked with Martin Luther King closely. So this was the caliber of the legal team that was put together for the defense.
Now, I don't want to have any spoilers, but this documentary uncovers new evidence about aspects of the trial and the pre-trial, the things that led up to the trial. I don't want to spoil anything, but let me give that to you. What do you want to tell us?
Well, so I have a couple of the lawyers who were involved in the original case, including William Kunstler's widow, Margaret, who's also a criminal defense lawyer, worked on the case, and I think maybe even met Kunstler on that case. And the way they express it, in the American criminal system, there's a pre-trial, so-called suppression hearing, where the defense kind of makes a case that evidence should be suppressed and shouldn't be allowed in the trial. And then you have the trial proper. The first part is done without a jury. And see, this is the legal education that my mother always wanted me to get. I got making this film. So in this case, Margaret Kunstler, as Margaret Kunstler puts it, you know, the suppression hearing was really the trial in this case, because what emerged were claims that the defendants confessed, which they never did by writing, by the way, but the defendants confessed based on being tortured, based on being pressured by a combination of the local cops and under the direction of the FBI. And reading these trial transcripts and the suppression hearing transcripts are unbelievable. Obviously, we have some excerpts illustrated in a way in the film. But we managed remarkably, yes, without giving away what it is, to get some remarkable admissions on camera for the first time.
And you're speaking to the players on both sides.
Oh, yes. It was my intention. I mean, the title for me, which in this case, sometimes they come early, sometimes they come late in the process. This title came to me early, and it was a way of kind of It's a complicated story with many moving parts. You've got great material, I might add. You have the makings of four great movies in there, potentially, at least. You know, you have a hijacking, you have the crime, you have a courtroom drama, and then you have the story of one of the most wanted American fugitives in Cuba today, as things are starting to open up and his days may be numbered.
So we only have a minute left, but today's the day that we have a change in presidency in the United States. Obama is, for the first time in half a century, he reopened diplomatic relations with Cuba. And now Trump is coming in, who has a hate on for that country. What do you think will happen to Ali?
Well, I'll be able to ask him because this person who's been on the FBI's most wanted list for 40 years is going to do a video Q&A at the theater at the opening, so we can ask, we can get it straight from the horse's mouth.
Wow.
I don't know. He's certainly going to drive a harder bargain over fugitives. That seems clear.
It's a fascinating story. Thanks so much for speaking with me, James.
Thank you, Daniel.
Jamie Kastner's new feature documentary, A Skyjacker's Tale, opens today in Toronto at the Hot Dog Cinema. This is Daniel Garber, the Movies, each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.